Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I get up early most days. First thing I do is turn on Morning Edition and wait for the weather. Is it going to rain today? Now, most times I trust what the forecasters have told the radio people, but sometimes they're wrong. Why is that, I wonder? With satellite technology today, we can all read the newspaper over the shoulder of a man at an outdoor cafe in Ulaanbaatar, but we're still not sure if it's going to rain during tomorrow's football game. Well, Peter Hobbs has made the understanding of precipitation his life's work. More to the point, what happens inside the clouds above us is the man's passion, his obsession, so much so that for the last 30 years he's been intentionally flying airplanes into the very center of storms that most sane people avoid. Connection listeners, we're exploring the insides of clouds today. Is the origin of precipitation something you'd like kept as a mystery, or are you one of these people who has to know more? And when you look at clouds, are you thinking art or science? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Peter Hobbs. He is the founder and head of the University of Washington's Cloud and Aerosol Research Group. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Seattle. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Dick. Pleased to be with you.
Tell me what the weather's like in Seattle this day.
Oh, it's very cold today. Well, we had a frost last night, but it's bright and clear, sort of unusual for Seattle.
No clouds in the sky?
No. In fact, the reason I came here some 30-odd years ago was I thought it was the cloud capital of the world. But recently, we're heading for a drought now.
Never seen one of those in 30 years, have you?
Oh, yes. We've seen a few droughts. In fact, in the 70s, we had quite a severe drought here, and I got involved in some cloud seeding to try to alleviate that.
Not a practice that you have a lot of time for, this cloud seeding, I gather.
Not these days, no. It's really not all that productive, and we've been doing many other things in recent years.
I think we may come back to cloud seeding, but I want to know what it is or what it was about the clouds above us that first caught your attention.
Well, I first became interested in clouds and meteorology in general when I was quite young, about 12 years old, when I was living in London, and an aunt of mine who worked in the British Weather Service took me up to the center of London and showed me the instruments they use for measuring winds and pressure and temperature and so on. And this sort of caught my attention. I became quite interested in it at that time and subsequently built a few instruments of my own and started to take observations. So by the age of 13 or 14, I was really into the subject.
And ready to apprentice yourself to Sir John Mason, Britain's sort of eminent atmospheric scientist at that point.
Well, yes, about the age of 14, I read in the newspaper that someone by the name of John Mason was going to give a talk in London on clouds and rainmaking. So I went to that talk and was really fascinated by the sort of research that he was doing. And after the talk, I went up to him and remember, I'm just a 14-year-old boy at this time, and said, I'd really like to join you and help in this research. And he said, well, you're a little young, but what you should do is go away and get a degree in physics or mathematics and then come back to see me. Well, he probably thought he'd never see me again, but about 10 years later, I turned up on his door and I said, well, I've got my degrees. How about it?
Did he remember who you were?
No, I don't think so. He
took you on.
Yeah, he took me on anyway. He said, that's fine. That's a nice story. And I worked with him for a few years and got my PhD with him. And then I came to the University of Washington in Seattle.
Now, Peter, when you began at the University of Washington, you were doing work from the ground, in some cases from mountainside or mountaintop observation post. But at some point you decided you needed to be up in the air, inside the clouds. What led you to that conclusion?
Yes, well, the work that Mason was doing in London and which I was involved in with him was all laboratory work, trying to understand little aspects of how clouds work, but through laboratory experiments. And when I came to the University of Washington, I started off doing similar experiments, but I quickly became sort of disillusioned with trying to understand the complex processes that occur in natural clouds through laboratory experiments. So I first of all went up onto Mount Olympus, which is west of Seattle, about 8,000 feet, and did some work up there in clouds as they drifted over the mountain. But of course, then you have to wait for the clouds to come, and it's quite an inhospitable place anyway, up at 8,000 feet in winter. And so I decided this really wasn't the way to do it. I needed to get mobility, and that meant getting a plane and going where the clouds were.
And, as I said earlier in the program, flying in some pretty unusual situations.
Yes, well, of course, if you're interested in clouds of various types, you are going where pilots generally are told not to go. Namely, you're trying to get in the clouds rather than out of them. So we've investigated clouds over mountains where icing conditions can be quite severe, and tropical clouds which are very deep and can be very vigorous in terms of turbulence and updrafts. So yes, you do get into unusual situations.
And did you?
Oh yes, on many occasions. We've been in we've had lightning flashes, lightning strike the aircraft and put our instruments out for a while. But not just clouds. A lot of our work has also been done looking at particles in the air and how they originate, which has taken us into volcanoes and effluents from volcanoes, into smoke from big fires, because we're interested in how these particles affect clouds.
Now, your group is called Cloud and Aerosol Research. The aerosol part of that is in fact the dust and the particles that you're talking about. Is that right?
Yes, that's the name we give to particles suspended in the air. We give them the fancy name of aerosol.
You forgive me. I thought it was something in a little can that went tsh.
Well, that also puts out particles, of course, aerosol particles. Aerosol is just particles suspended in some medium such as air.
I want to go back to the inside of the cloud, to the study of rain, because if I think back to my grade 7 science textbook and the little arrows that go round and round inside a cloud, making little pieces of ice which eventually go up and then come down and melt and land as rain, what more do we need to know? What are we missing?
Well, of course, most clouds don't rain, and so that's an interesting point right off. Why is it that some clouds rain and others do not? And why do clouds over the ocean differ from clouds over the land in terms of how efficiently they rain? In order for a cloud to rain, remember, the particles in a cloud are very, very tiny. They're less than the width of a hair. But in order to form a raindrop, some of those droplets in the cloud, those very tiny droplets, have to increase in size by a million times. And they have to do that within the lifetime of a cloud, which may be half an hour. So one of the outstanding questions is, how do a few of the particles grow so rapidly and so enormously to form raindrops?
Now, in your early days, back in the 70s, you were sticking sticks out of the windows of airplanes with gooey stuff on them to try and measure those ice crystals. Am I right?
Yes. In the 60s, when we started this airborne research, the instrumentation was fairly crude. And one of the things we wanted to do was to sample these small particles in clouds. And one way of doing that was to basically open the window of your plane and stick out a stick that had a sticky material on it, and then the particles in the cloud would hit that stick, and they would be captured in the gooey material, as you say. And in fact, the gooey material we used even allowed the ice crystals, if they were ice crystals, to melt and yet leave behind a replica. And then we could pull back the stick and we'd have a plastic replica of the ice crystal, which we could look at under the microscope and take a look at the nature of the ice crystal.
And things are a little fancier now, the equipment that you're working with.
Yes, of course, now with modern electronics and computers and so on, we have instruments that can basically photograph these little tiny particles as they fly through the air and display them inside the aircraft on a sort of a TV, television monitor. And we can see millions of these particles flying by the aircraft, and we can see them in great detail, just as if you were looking at them under a microscope.
Do they look like raindrops splattering on the screen? What actual images do you see?
Well, the most interesting images are when you're flying in ice crystal clouds, and a lot of the rain that reaches the ground starts off as ice particles, and the ice particles grow as they fall through the cloud, and then generally they melt before they hit the ground and hit the ground as rain, but they started off as ice. Of course, if it's cold on the ground, they hit the ground as snowfall. So one of the most interesting things in flying in clouds is to look at these little ice crystals and study how they grow. So, for example, you could start flying at the top of the cloud and you'll see little tiny particles. And then as you fly lower and lower in the cloud, you'll see these particles increase in size. And by studying them on these images, you can determine how they're growing, how they increase in size by this factor of a million times that I mentioned previously.
Now, we need to remember that you're inside the middle of what could be a storm cloud while you're doing this. Are you, in effect, turning on all your equipment and flying through the cloud and just holding on like this and then reading everything when you come out the other side? Are you actually trying to do work while you're inside and banging around?
No, most of our measurements we see in real time in the cloud. And yes, we are being, if the cloud is turbulent, we may be thrown around. Of course, not all clouds are turbulent. Some are quite benign. But we're measuring some 60 different parameters every second in the plane.
And every second?
Every second we're getting a measurement of something. 60 parameters are measured every second, actually, roughly. So it's an enormous data stream, and we have in the back of the plane a lot of people, my students, graduate students, and staff people that work with me that are looking at various monitors and trying to interpret what's going on in real time. But most of the analysis, however, is done after we get back on the ground, when we can spend more time trying to figure out what was going on.
And we'll talk about what was going on when we come back after our break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Peter Hobbs is my guest this hour. He is founder and head of the University of Washington's Cloud and Aerosol Research Group, speaking to us from the cloud capital of the world, or so some people consider, Seattle, Washington. We'll also talk a little bit about some of the dramatic flying he's done in places like Kuwait and Mount St. Helens. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The death toll among the little...
Look up, way up in the sky. Who hasn't gazed at the clouds and wondered what that one means or why that one looks the way it does? My guest this hour, Peter Hobbs, a professor of atmospheric science, founder and director of the Cloud and Aerosol Research Group at the University of Washington, and has spent more time inside clouds than most of the rest of us have, looking at them from the ground. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, where we will entertain your cloud questions or cloud stories. I'm going to ask Ken McMillan to join us now. Ken is a retired Navy commander, pilot extraordinaire, has flown corporate jets and just about every other kind of aircraft since he retired in 1975. In fact, Ken, you did a fair amount of flying with Peter Hobbs in these unusual circumstances?
An awful lot of it, yes.
So what kind of a guy is he like to work with up there?
Well, I've got to say, of course, we sit up front and he sits in the back, and we're talking to each other on the intercom. But no matter how rough it gets, he was always very cool and collected back there. And maybe he just didn't realize, or is an extremely brave person considering the conditions that we're flying in.
Now, it's your job as a pilot to know just how much you can tolerate, how much the aircraft can tolerate. So did you find yourself kind of caught between Peter Hobbs' desire to stay up and your own knowledge that if you tried, you might actually just not stay up?
Oh, frequently. But I have to admit that when I said no or we had to do something else or get out of there, he was very responsive to that. And while he, you know, might make a slight protest to stay in the stuff a little bit longer, if I were to insist, he followed my lead there.
And how do you know, Ken, when you're sort of at that margin of safety or danger? Is it just experience?
I think it's just experience. It has to be. Having done it for a while, a long time, in fact, you get a feel for, you know, when that airplane is approaching a point where you can't control it, and it's time to go.
Ken McMillan is a retired Navy commander and a pilot with Peter Hobbs, who's my guest this hour. Peter, I'm going to turn to our phones and let some of our listeners in here. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Louisville, Kentucky. Michael's with us. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have wondered for years why clouds are flat on the bottom.
Me too. Peter, got an answer?
Well, not all clouds are flat on the bottom, of course. If you look at them carefully, many of them have sort of undulating bases to them, but particularly layered clouds, as we call them, horizontally extensive clouds. But many cumulus clouds, the puffy ones, many of those have flat bottoms, and it's basically because the air beneath them is very well mixed, it's very uniform, and therefore when air rises from the ground, which is the first stage in the formation of a cloud, water condenses to form droplets, which is the way a cloud forms, at a well-defined height above the ground because the air itself is so uniform over a large horizontal area. So that will give you a very uniform cloud base height.
Meaning nothing will condense below that one specific layer.
Very, very little, yes. Now, if on the other hand you had very inhomogeneous air, then one parcel of air that rises up would condense and produce cloud base, say, at 2,000 feet, and another neighboring parcel of air that maybe is a little drier would have to be lifted maybe to 2,500 feet before condensation occurred. So then there'd be a big difference in cloud base height.
Michael, can you sleep tonight?
I think so. That's a wonderful, wonderful answer. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. To Waltham, Massachusetts. Phil's on the line. Hello, Phil.
Yes, hello. I wanted to ask a question about historical weather patterns, and I have in mind the Great Fire in Siberia in 1914 that covered most of Siberia. And this fire has been used by DIA and various Pentagon groups to study the effects of nuclear winter. And do you know anything about this fire and whether it is as important a study as we are led to believe?
Well, I don't know anything specifically about the Siberian fire. What year was it? A little before my time, I think.
1914.
Yeah, a little before my time. But fires are very important worldwide in a number of ways, and we've studied emissions from fires in Brazil and fairly recently in Southern Africa to look at their effects on the atmosphere, and the They have effects because of the large number of particles they put in the air, which can affect the solar radiation, the sun's radiation reaching the ground. So they play a role in global climate and local climates as well. And they can also affect the structure of clouds. So emissions from fires are very important, and perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that later.
Well, let's talk about Kuwait if we can, because your story of actually getting access to and flying around all those burning oil wells after the first Gulf War. Listen to me already. After the Gulf War of 1991.
Yeah, let's hope it's the first
or last.
Yes,
you had some trouble getting there.
Well, yes, we were asked by various agencies of the U.S. government to go to Kuwait in, I think it was March 1991, to look at the effects of the smoke coming from those over 600 fires in Kuwait. And at that time, and this gets back to the question we just had, there was speculation by a number of scientists that maybe that enormous amount of smoke would affect climate worldwide. And we went there to try to see if that might be the case. So we were based in Bahrain, and when we arrived, the Iraqi army had just recently been pushed out of Kuwait. And the first problem was to fly over Kuwait. There was no air traffic control. Ken McMillan, that we just spoke to, our pilot.
He's still with us.
Yeah, good. And Ken was a great pilot for us. He was actually far braver than he tries to make out. So we had trouble getting permission because there was no one in control of airspace.
What was happening with that, Ken? Can you fill us in on that?
Well, after many attempts on the telephone and speaking to people around Bahrain, I managed to hitch a ride on a naval aircraft up to Kuwait itself, and as luck would have it, in wandering around the airport terminal there, which was all bombed out, I ran across, you know, there always seems to be that one individual through whom you can get anything, and he took me to one of the Kuwaitis who was in charge of air traffic control, and through him, we managed to get some phone numbers and fax numbers, and by which we could get permission to fly each day up into the Kuwaiti airspace. So thank God for the Navy over there. They were a great help to us in moving us around so that we could coordinate our activities.
Now, give us a picture, Ken. Were you flying actually through the plumes that we remember seeing from those burning wells?
Yes. There was kind of a... in the midst of the oil fields, with all of these burning wells, at one place it was nothing but a thick fog with a very flat top at about 3,000 feet, and the visibility was at zero below it. And after flying around a bit, Peter had asked that we hit that heavy, dense cloud. And so I think that we went through probably at about 2,500 feet, 500 feet from the top. And the minute we entered it, our airplane was immediately filled with smoke. You could barely see the instruments, and we're in turbulence, which is almost as bad as anything I've ever been in. And fortunately, we knew that the other side was probably 3 minutes away, and all we could do was just hold on for those 3 minutes until we popped out the other side.
Peter, did you get anything useful on that pass?
Oh yes, we got a lot of very useful data in that whole study. We were there for 6 weeks, and we probably flew 100 hours or more. The plume of smoke was so enormous. To give you an idea, it was visually apparent over a distance equivalent to New York down to Florida. An enormous plume. And
wait a second. If I was looking north from Florida, I'd have seen it. That distance away, that's how big it was.
Yes, if, for example, the fires were in New York,
right,
the smoke was still apparent.
It's almost hard to imagine.
Many hundreds of miles away.
Yeah.
And so we were able to look at what was coming out of the fires. Very little work had been done on oil fires previously in terms of quantitative measurements. And we were able to investigate what effects it was having on the atmosphere. And it obviously was having an enormous effect on the region, but we came to the conclusion that it wasn't having a global effect.
So if we go back to the question of Phil's that prompted this in terms of understanding what the effect of all these particles, the aerosol, can be on the weather, if we talk about big volcanic eruptions like Mount St. Helens, you're probably that's one that you studied. Can that have a global effect?
Yes. Large volcanic eruptions can have global effects. As you may recall, the early one of Krakatoa in Indonesia, when that erupted, it produced what they called a winter that went through the summers for a couple of years. So very large volcanic eruptions have global effects. St. Helens is one of my most vivid memories, and I don't think Ken was with us when we did St. Helens, but that was 1980, and it went off about 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning.
Okay.
And I woke up with a start. I heard the big explosion, and got on the phone and scrambled my crew as quickly as I could. And we got out and were heading in our aircraft to Mount St. Helens a few hours later. And we saw this enormous plume. I'd never seen anything so big, going vertically upwards, up for 50,000 feet or more. And obviously we had to approach that very cautiously.
Describe that for us. What it looked like?
Well, first of all, the thing that struck me was it wasn't moving. It just seemed to be stationary. And what I wasn't comprehending was how big it was. One's just not used to seeing anything that huge. But as we got closer to it, then we started to see all the motions on various scales in the smoke. And there were lightning flashes and there were forest fires. And we obviously weren't going to go into that. So we kept on the outside of it a bit and moved downwind. And when we were about 30 or 40 miles downwind, I asked the pilot to just venture a little closer into the edge of the plume. And at this point, we hear bang, bang, bang. Things are hitting the plane. And I thought that was it because I thought these were rocks. But as it turned out, these things that hit the plane just disintegrated as soon as they hit it. They were, in fact, conglomerates of large numbers of particles, which I called afterwards volcanic hail.
Like a sort of dust ball?
Dust balls, yes, because they were so highly charged that and so present in such high concentrations in the plume that the particles were just coagulating together just by electrical forces. But as soon as they hit the plane, they just disintegrated, so they didn't do any damage. Anyway, on that day, we did sample various parts of the plume, although we didn't go right through it until we got quite a ways downwind into Idaho. We were up flying for about 6 hours on that day and probably got the most comprehensive data set on emissions from volcanoes that is still in existence now.
Now, forgive me a non-scientific question, but when you're studying the atmospheric effect of something like the Kuwaiti oil fires or Mount St. Helens, what use is the information that you're gathering right at the very source, before it's had an opportunity to spread out and affect the weather in the way that we've been taught it will?
Well, first of all, you want to know what's coming out. I mean, are the particles likely to be cloud active? What heights are the particles being elevated to? The higher they get elevated, the more widespread they'll be dispersed around the globe. Are there any toxic materials there? So information on the nature of the emissions provides information on what their subsequent evolution and effects will be on the atmosphere.
And having done it once, are you now watching Mount Etna in Italy and wondering what the effects of that will be and where it's going to go?
Well, Mount Etna is traditionally an outgassing sort of volcano rather than a violent explosive one, although, of course, any volcano can become explosive. But its emissions are far less than something like Mount St. Helens.
What I hear you saying, Peter, is that you can't actually separate the study of clouds from the study of the particles that are also a part of the atmosphere, that they're just too much linked together if you're trying to understand them scientifically?
Yes, well, every cloud droplet forms on a particle in the air. Only a small fraction of the particles in the air act in this respect. But So the number of cloud droplets and their sizes are determined by the particles in the air. And we need to know what the contribution of humans is to those particles compared with the contribution of natural sources.
Mm-hmm. Ken McMillan, back to you. When you spend time with someone like Peter Hobbs, it's a little different from flying for the Navy. Do you get a chance to learn about the clouds that you spend so much time flying through?
Yes. You know, there are frequent opportunities over dinner, I guess, or a drink after a flight where the conversation naturally turns to what we've done during the day. And so, yes, I've come away with a new appreciation, I guess, for clouds and certainly the study of them.
And if you were to try and pluck from those dinner table conversations perhaps the piece of knowledge about clouds that Peter left you from the time that all the years that you were flying together, what would that be? Could you pluck something out?
Well, I've done a lot of flying over the North Atlantic and up in Alaska in places where there is considerable ice. But in flying with Peter, I've developed an even greater appreciation for ice and primarily the dangers associated with it.
Which means that now you are a little bit more careful or a little more reckless?
No, I thought I was very careful before, but I've since learned just how bad icing can become on an aircraft in working with Peter. And
go ahead, Peter.
We always felt very safe with Ken, and certainly if he said let's get out of it, we didn't argue. We got out of it. So he was a great pilot.
And you two don't fly anymore together, do you?
No, we, after 30 years of this type of work, I thought that was about enough. And at the end of last year, we sold our research aircraft. And now we're just analyzing the enormous amounts of data that we've collected over those years. And that's going to keep us busy for quite a few more years.
Ken McMillan, I want to thank you for being with us.
You're certainly welcome, and I've enjoyed it.
Ken McMillan, retired Navy commander, has been flying with Peter Hobbs since 1989, but as Peter pointed out, that work ended just about a year ago as they plow their way through all the data that they've collected inside the clouds. Connection listeners, your thoughts, your ideas, your questions about what's up there and in there. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WB.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Peter Hobbs, professor of atmospheric science, founder and director of the Cloud and Aerosol Research Group at the University of Washington. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Peter, a little earlier in the program, we talked about cloud seeding and a suspicion that you have about that, but you've messed with it yourself, have you not?
Oh, yes. In the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, cloud seeding was a very active area of research, the hope being that we could increase precipitation, rainfall in certain situations. And so my group did quite a bit of research on that subject in the 70s.
And concluded that it's a pretty spotty bit of science?
It's very difficult to increase rainfall in a reliable and useful manner by cloud seeding. We know we can modify the structure of clouds by seeding, and in some cases we can produce showers. But to really significantly increase rainfall in a reliable manner and in a certain target area has not yet really been achieved yet.
Now, there was a report out of Mexico, I think last year, sort of raising expectations once again that perhaps someone had found a secret way of seeding the clouds and causing more rainfall?
Well, that's not a secret way. It's a way that's been investigated previously, but people keep trying, and with the new technology, one can do a better job. But it still hasn't been demonstrated that it's a useful technology.
Can I ask you a sort of non-scientific question about whether or not you think the idea of either creating or controlling weather is something that scientists ought to be working towards anyway?
Well, you know, you must have discussed this subject on your program at other times. If something is possible or if something's out there that needs investigating, then it will be investigated, whether it's right or wrong.
Right.
Let's put it this way. If we could control rainfall, for example, I wouldn't want to be the one that decides when it rains and when it doesn't.
Do you think that we'll ever get to that point?
Possibly in a small sort of way over certain regions. We might be able to increase rainfall modestly sometime in the future.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Blue Hill Observatory in Milton, Massachusetts. And Don's joining us. Hi, Don.
Hi. Hi, this has a little bit to do with the cloud seeding, but much more going back to the fires.
Yeah, go ahead.
Recently, a TV meteorologist was pointing out that there are certain times when if there are too many particles in the sky or the size of the particles is incorrect, it will actually prevent clouds from forming. And I was wondering if Peter could explain that in a little more detail or his understanding of that phenomena.
Yes, not so much prevent clouds forming, but if you've got a lot of particles in the air, which you have when you've got very smoky conditions, as I mentioned before, every cloud droplet forms on a particle in the air. So if you've got lots of particles, you get lots of cloud droplets. But if you've got lots of cloud droplets, the average size of the droplets is quite small, and therefore the cloud is less likely to rain because you have to get big droplets for it to rain. So high concentrations of pollutants can reduce rainfall from clouds.
Okay, that explains it very simply and well. One quick follow-up. I know you've been a tremendous study of the clouds from the airplanes and everything like that. Do you also study the clouds from the ground?
I don't personally, but there are remote sensing instruments, both from the ground and from satellites, that can provide information on clouds. And a lot of our recent work has been flying beneath satellites in order to see how the satellite measurements compare with our airborne measurements. In other words, sort of seeing if we can validate some of the satellite measurements. Because in the future, satellites are probably going to provide a lot of information on a global sort of basis on cloud properties.
You mean that the weather balloons of my childhood and the ground observation and the flights that you're talking about, these are all ways of, in effect, double-checking what the satellites are telling us?
Well, no, they can provide a lot of information that you're never going to get from satellites. Satellites are in their infancy in terms of what they can provide, what information they can provide about the atmosphere. For example, they can, in principle, provide a temperature profile through the atmosphere, which is what we currently generally get by launching a balloon, what we call a radio sonde, and measuring the temperature basically with a thermometer as it's carried up with the balloon. Satellites can, in principle, provide those temperature measurements, but they're not sufficiently reliable yet under all conditions that we would want to dispense with the global network of radio sondes.
All right, Don, thanks for your call. Let's go to Waltham, Mass. Now, and Sarah's on the line. Sarah, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I was wondering if Dr. Hobbs, it's a fascinating program. I was interested in whether Dr. Hobbs was at all familiar with the work of Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who was working with clouds, but not in the airplanes. He worked from the ground with what he called a doorbuster, and he could clear clouds so that they would go away, bust up and fade away, and also he could prevent rain for certain occasions, such as once at Rangeley, Maine. I think that's where his laboratory was. And they said, could you ensure that we won't have rain on the 4th of July? And he said, well, he'd try that. And so he used his doorbuster.
Did it work, Sarah?
It worked, and they were very grateful. I think they paid him $100 or something. I think he did it maybe for free as an experiment to see whether it would work, and it did.
Professor Hobbs, do you know this man we're talking about?
No, I don't know this particular man, but it sounds to me like the rainmaker or the drought producer comes to town type of thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people have made claims like this, and you say he did, in fact, stop it raining, but how do you know it wouldn't have stopped raining anyway? That's the question.
Well, that's a good question.
If you try to modify clouds, you have to make sure that you demonstrate that in a very mathematical, sort of statistical manner, in the same way as we try to verify if a certain medication really works or doesn't work. And that's the problem. There's such large variability in clouds and rainfall that you don't know if you go and put some chemical or do something to a cloud whether you've changed its what it would have done naturally anyway.
Well, if you ever became interested in such work as was done from the ground by Dr. Reich, there are a lot of books that he wrote, and they're all available. Reinhardt, they're a publisher, I think they did his works. And I don't know that he wrote a book on clouds, because this was late in his life. And I proved for myself, by building a little small doorbuster, that I could bust up the clouds.
Okay, what's a doorbuster, Sarah? You're going to have to tell me what you're...
Well, it's not really a machine. It's something you create... with a box, wood, and in it you put pipes, and the pipes are aimed at the clouds, and from the box you have to have something leading to water. And as long as you've got yourself near some water, you can drop a chain in there or a pipe, then you can use it.
Now, does yours work, Sarah?
Yes, I've done it. I've done it in the Hudson River.
I have to tell you, it sounds a little like snake oil to me.
Well, he didn't work quantitatively, but his books are published, and one of the biographies of him talks about his work in Arizona, where he was able to produce some grass where there had never been any grass. So he was a
I'll tell you that Dr. Hobbs has on the shelves of scientists the sort of industry standard books on clouds. But Peter,
some people have claimed that they can dissipate clouds just by thought process, just by thinking about it. You have to submit all such claims to proper statistical analysis, which takes actually years. And this is why cloud seeding experiments have not yet been proven successful, because it's so difficult to obtain the statistical significance that's necessary to convince scientists and mathematicians that you've really done something.
1-800-423-8255. Sarah, thanks for your call. Let's go to Shropshire in the UK. Christopher's listening via satellite, Christopher?
Yes, that's correct. World space.
Go ahead, Christopher.
Could you tell me how the atmosphere determines what type of cloud we are given, such as the cumulonimbus, etc.?
Yes, well, you get the convective type of cumulus clouds when you've got heating of the surface of the Earth, which differs from one location to another. So you get hot spots where air is heated more and it rises and produces a convective, fluffy type of cumulus cloud. On the other hand, if you've got widespread and much slower lifting of air, which you get typically with frontal systems, so you're lifting air at centimeters per second upwards over large areas, that will give you the layer type of stratus clouds.
Christopher, thanks for your call. Nice to have you with us from halfway around the world. To Providence, Rhode Island, John's on the line. John.
Yes, I wondered if you could... Did I hear you say that most rain does not come from clouds, or that most clouds don't produce rain? And
Most clouds do not produce rain.
Where does the rain come from?
No, I didn't say rain comes from anything other than clouds. I said that many clouds just evaporate and do not produce rain.
I see. And are the ice crystals then the nucleus for the enlarging drops? Do the drops themselves have a variation in shape and character, such as a snowflake?
There are two basic mechanisms for producing rain. One just involves droplets that, in which some of the droplets grow very rapidly into raindrop size. Another mechanism is through ice crystals. So if you get some ice crystals in a cloud, they can grow very rapidly and big enough that they start to fall out as snow and maybe melt on the way down. So those are the two basic mechanisms for forming precipitation.
John, thanks for your call. Peter, if I were to come to your office as a 14-year-old boy saying, gee, I'd really like to work with you, I know what you'd say. You'd send me away to get a degree and tell me to come back. But if I asked you where the science is going in our understanding of clouds, what's next? How would you describe that?
Well, first of all, I would encourage anyone to work on this problem, because I think it's one of the most important that one can work on in terms of the fact that life on Earth depends on clouds being there and precipitation, which then feeds crops and so on. There are many things we don't know about clouds. We don't fully understand their effects on global radiation and global warming. There's a whole area of research that could be taken up, which hardly anyone's done yet, on how microbes in the air are transported by convective currents and then get into clouds and are moved around in the atmosphere and finally get deposited somewhere else on the globe through precipitation processes. The microbiology of clouds, as it were. There's the whole area of we referred to before of the use of satellites for monitoring cloud properties and precipitation worldwide. So many problems for young people to get into.
It fascinates me that so much is left to learn about something that's been there and been studied for so long.
Really only been studied properly for 100 years or so.
Gazed at for a lot longer than that, I suppose.
Certainly gazed at since man's been on this earth, I suppose, or humans have been on this earth, yes.
Now, the forecast is for some cloud in Seattle this weekend. When you look up and see clouds, do you see something different from the other person standing on the street looking up?
Well, I still enjoy the beauty of clouds, but maybe I see a little bit more. I don't know.
Make you want to get up there flying again, or have you had enough?
I think 30 years is enough for that. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing at the moment.
And lots to go through. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great fun, Dick.
Dr. Peter Hobbs, founder and director of the Cloud and Aerosol Research Group at the University of Washington. Earlier, we talked with Ken McMillan, retired Navy commander, former pilot for the CAR Group. Connection listeners, please feel free to continue the conversation about clouds on our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. This is